Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
My next guest has been on the show several times before talking about brain health, but her latest book is a mix of the practical, yes, but also the personal. Neuroscientist and psychologist Dr. Sabina Brennan, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
So the book is called Still Me, A Neuroscientist's Guide to Caring for Someone with Dementia. But the reason it's personal is because you did care for someone with dementia, your late mother, Colette. So as well as the book being full of information for people who are thrown into this kind of world they don't understand, you also tell a bit of your own story throughout the book. Tell me about how your mother got diagnosed, because I think this is interesting and it will ring bells with a lot of people.
It will, because, and I'm glad you've asked that question, because mum's diagnosis kind of followed a storyline, so to speak, that affects a lot of people and something that's very important to raise awareness about and something that we could change in a way. So mum basically, she got a UTI. And like a lot of older people, she didn't mount a temperature with her. With it, as we get older, we lose our ability to mount a temperature the way we used to. So you can have a very serious urinary tract infection and not have a temperature. And a lot of older people would think, and actually a lot of younger people, you kind of think you don't need to go to the doctor unless you have a temperature. That's a sign you have an infection. So again, like a lot of older people, my mum, like, she loved to go into town every day, every morning, and she found she kind of couldn't make it to the bus stop without needing to go to the bathroom. She had increased frequency, which is a sign of UTI. And so she started limiting the fluids she was drinking so that she could continue what she was doing. And of course, that exacerbated the infection and she ended up actually with acute delirium. And I mean, just to explain to people, I was on my way into work. She rang me. She said, "Will you meet me for lunch today?" And I said, "I can't, Mum. I have meetings all day. Tomorrow's Saturday. We'll meet on Saturday." About half an hour later, I'm in the office and I get a call from a brother of mine that lives with her, has lived with my parents sort of all his life kind of thing. And he said, "Sabina, come home. Mum's acting really weird. I don't know what to do. I need help, you know." And she was trying to leave the house. She wasn't fully dressed. She was only in a slip and she was becoming aggressive to leave the house. Now, this was within a half an hour of me speaking to her reasonably. So I went into, I was working with a geriatric psychiatrist at the time. I shared an office with him and I said, "Can't do any meetings. Have to go home. Mum's acting strange." And he said, "Get a urine sample. Sounds like she has delirium from a UTI." So track forward, she then ends up actually spending about 6 months in an acute hospital. She has severe delirium for quite a long time. Now, I want to say to people, anyone can get delirium from a very bad infection. When it's dehydration and UTI, it's cytokines in your brain, attack your brain and make you behave strangely and out of character, and you can be psychotic and you can see things.
But a lot of people will then come back.
Yes, that's the key point I want to say, is that most people, you can recover from delirium and most people will come back and unaffected. However, if you have an underlying mild cognitive impairment, what seems to happen is the delirium then accelerates the progression of your symptoms and you end up then with a diagnosis much worse.
Okay, so it can be quite sudden in that situation.
And it's a sliding door. If we could raise awareness about delirium and UTIs and get people going to doctors, we could stop that.
Yeah.
And people could, my mother could have continued for a few more years without severe symptoms.
So
I'm kind of glad you brought that up. But that was mum's.
Yeah. Because look, you went to any A&E and half the old people in there are delirious and
looked
after quickly.
Yes, and can be misconstrued as if it was dementia when it's actually delirium from an infection.
Did you never tell your mother she had dementia? No,
I didn't. First of all, I should, you know, in a professional capacity, I should say that there is lots of benefits to getting an early diagnosis, particularly the emphasis there on early, because there are things that you can do, you know, boosting your brain health. Once you get a diagnosis of dementia, you don't give up. You actually need to really work harder at your brain health, because that can help push out your symptoms for longer.
Okay.
You can put your affairs in order. And that usually refers to financial affairs and power of attorney. But I actually, in the book, talk at great length about the importance of actually just writing notes down about things you like. The things, you know, don't ever dress me in green. You know, don't give me ambrosia or creamed rice. Just write it, because they're the things that make life kind of worth living. So I will say that there's huge benefits to that. In my mum's case, she was kind of quite progressed, lacked an awareness that, you know, she kind of had dementia, knew there was kind of things wrong. When she ultimately sort of ended up in a, you know, in a care home, she used to talk to me about how she felt terrible sorry for the other women in there. They had that terrible disease and some of them can't talk. And I go over and I talk to them and, you know, try to kind of, you know, interact with them. And I brought her to, there's photos I have, you know, in some of the publicity accompanying this. And it's of me with my mum when I took her out to, I think it's only about a year before she died. I took her out to an Alzheimer's event where they were showing videos of that they had just made of younger people caring for their parents with young onset dementia. And my mum sat and watched the films and she said, oh, isn't that just such a terrible disease, those poor people. Okay. So to me...
So she didn't need to know.
No, to me, she didn't need to know. I think it's very personal. I think it's very on an individual basis. I think doctors sometimes don't disclose. Look, from a human rights perspective, they have the right to know and you know, can be told, etc. I think we're dealing with humans and loved ones and you make those decisions on that basis. And I felt it would have made mum much more depressed. She was prone to depression. And I think in a way it would have taken hope and you know, away. So I think you kind of weigh those things up.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a couple of things come out of that, which is one thing you say about taking her out to the thing. You took an attitude, I know, which was to recognise your own personal limitations and go, okay, I can offer care here. But you actually say in the book, I knew I didn't have the patience for kind of doing it all the time. So you would do, say, weekends, short bursts, and try and make it as life-affirming and joyous as possible.
So what I want, I mean, you know, the first third of this book is about self-care for the carer, because it, you know, even if, and as I say, even if you're a daughter who's visiting three times a week and taking one day, you're a carer. That impacts hugely on every aspect of your life. And I suppose the reason I told my own story is because this is not about a book of me saying, here's how you care, because I made loads of mistakes. It's a book about trying to help people understand you don't have to do it all. It is important to understand what your own limitations are. I knew I don't have the patience for it. My husband was brilliant. He had much more patience. He could also do a lot of the later stage stuff that I couldn't do, the incontinence. He was amazing. I know I couldn't have done that. I would have been throwing up. And that's often a point where, you know, it accelerates the amount of care you need, etc. So I think acknowledging what you can and can't do.
Yeah.
I know I could do stimulation with my mom. We took a weekend, Saturdays and Sundays for the most part. And that was great and that was enjoyable. And she had fun with, like, she would sit and watch soccer games with my husband. She'd never done that before, but she had a bit of an eye for my husband.
This came out over the course of things.
Yeah. And I'm not alone in that, actually. I was talking to Davina McCall on her podcast this week and I told her the story about my mum fancying my husband and enjoying time with him. And he was brilliant. He just played along. And she said her gran had dementia. And she apologised to Davina and asked her, she hoped she really didn't mind her having an affair with her husband because he's just too gorgeous to resist, you know.
And this is another interesting aspect of it. You're very much about going with the person in the moment where you can. So, like, there's a thing called, I didn't know it was called time shifting.
Yes.
Where the person with dementia will think they're in the past at a different point in their life and everything. Tell me about this thing, respectful responding or validation therapy. That you don't hit them too hard with the realities of things.
It's very important to meet them in their reality. Because whether it's the same as yours, they don't have the capacity to distinguish. So they, whatever their experience is experiencing is real for them in the moment. And arguing with them, contradicting them, actually will probably only end up in some of the more challenging behaviours that you're trying to minimise.
And I think you learned this the hard way.
I did, unfortunately. Mum had been, she'd been living in a care home for quite a while at this point. It was a Saturday. She was home in the house, you know, and we were just chatting and just out of the blue, she just said to me, Sabina, why doesn't your dad come to visit me? And I just kind of instant reaction was, oh, Mum, Dad's dead. And I'll never forget my son. I can still see my son sitting there and me. And it was just the first time she'd heard it. And she just said, oh, my God, where, when, what happened? How come I didn't know? And it was, oh, my God, it was just so awful because we all, in that moment, I had to answer those questions and we all kind of relived it.
So grieving she had done already was done.
Oh, she had grieved. It was just like, oh, it was terrible. And the really interesting thing was for me, a lesson I learned, because I'm, you know, one of the key tenets in this book is to recognize that the living, breathing, thinking, feeling, loving individual is still there. In there.
Yeah.
They may not have language. They may not interact in the same way as they did before. Because I'd been thinking, you know, oh, Mum's just kind of going on day to day. She's not doing too bad. But she'd clearly been agonizing in her head why her husband wasn't coming. The love of her life wasn't coming to visit her. And then I distracted her later in the day. That seemed to work well. And then when my husband brought her back up into the care home about 9 o'clock on the Saturday night, when they opened the door to the care home, the first thing my mother said with emotion and tears was, oh my God, my Pat is dead. So to my mind, she had also played the game with me to an extent of distraction because it was still there. It was still at the forefront of her head.
And that thing you say about that, but the, like it's in the title of the book, the person is still there. Like you talk about how they may seem like a child sometimes, but don't treat them like a child.
Absolutely not. That person, respect who they always have been to you. If they were your mother, they're still your mother. Treat them with respect. The difference between is, so some of their behaviours may appear childlike, especially as they move through symptoms and they might have trouble eating or feeding or, you know. The thing is, a child is developing. So when you interact with a child and you correct a child and you say, no, do it this way, the child will learn. The child's brain has the capacity to learn. An Alzheimer's brain is degenerating. You're losing brain cells, you're losing connections, you're losing the ability to learn. So you are losing those things that you learnt along the way, but you're not a child because you've lost the capacity to relearn them. And I think what is important, and if you take my mum's case as an example there, that the person is still in there, even though they can't communicate, even if they've lost language.
Yeah,
they still need the things we all need.
Okay, yeah,
you know, and still have the capacity for depression.
People can tend to talk over them,
and
particularly when language starts going as if they're not there.
Yes, so, and the thing is, that's why I talk about language is just one way we communicate, and that's why I talk about, you know, really paying subtle attention to subtle nuances and changes. You know, that when you're talking to someone,
they're all communication.
They're all communication. So you really have to become a little bit of a detective, particularly if language goes, and trying to find ways they can change. You're the one who has the capacity to kind of try and find, and that
you see. I think that could be. This whole area of that they are not a child and treat them like the person they were, I'd say it's very challenging if that person is your life partner.
Yes.
And as you point out, they might have been your confidant. Precisely for a crisis like this that you might be dealing with. They're the one you'd have turned to.
Yes.
And it must be difficult for people to still see the person as a partner and not to see them as, I'm now a carer to this.
Yeah. I think you raise a couple of important things there. I can't imagine what it must be like. You know, it's different when you're a mother. I do think it's important to anyone listening who has that. You can still talk to them. You can still share your end of the day with them. You may not get a response. However, depending on the type of dementia, you may at some point get a little moment of insight. Do you know, something might come out. So you can still share it. But I think it's important to cultivate another confidant, somebody that you can offload on, somebody that you can seek support with. I think that's really important. I think partner or spousal caregivers are in a very, very difficult position. I think we need much more supports for them. They're often old themselves with conditions. And I think shame on us as a society that we don't provide more support. And I hope this book would kind of start a conversation on that too.
Back to the person with dementia then, just before we leave that. You talk about this thing of them having an emotional memory of
people. Yes.
Like that even if they don't know your name anymore. They have a vibe of
So memory, the emotional memory, to put it very simply, the processes associated with emotional memory occur in a different part of the brain to the processes that affect the memory, you know, for recent events or whatever. So whilst your mom or your dad or your spouse may not know your name, may confuse you for, my mom sometimes called me Ethel, but she never stopped to, Ethel was her sister, but she never stopped knowing who I was for most part of the time. She would occasionally say the wrong thing, probably when she was time shifting. They might forget your name. They may forget that you were there yesterday, which is why this respectful responding is so important. There's no point in you can announce who you are, but there's no point in pushing an issue and saying, do you not remember I came in yesterday? We did such and such, or I'm your daughter. Because if you focus on the present, on having a good time, what they will remember is that person, when you come into the room, this is someone I have fun with.
Okay.
Whereas if you keep correcting and, you know, reminding, they'll go, this person doesn't make me feel good.
Okay.
And it is a real lesson in life to just focus on the moment. And a lesson I learned in terms with my mum, my relationship, I had much better times with my mum after her diagnosis than before. And I have heard that from other people too.
That a lot of the baggage you might have had before, really, So you just have these...
You just let go and it's a lesson for life. If we just let go and be in the moment, life is more enjoyable, you know?
Yeah. One little practical thing, you talk about what we might call safetyism, of not letting people take risks and being excessively...
I do talk about that a lot in the book.
Yeah,
it's kind of, it's a little bit controversial in other countries. They're adopting sort of, you know, the kind of view I have. I think if you do, as I talk, actually, I refer to being a partnership, a care partner, because I think if we become a caregiver, we can disempower the person. And out of love and kindness, we start doing things for the person. When that comes to dementia, you are actually accelerating the disease by doing things for them. It's always easier to do it for them. You know, but doing with them takes more effort, but it allows them to stay independent for longer or able to do certain things. And I think, unfortunately, when we go into care homes, etc., they're cooked, the foods are cooked for them, they're washed, they're dressed, autonomy is taken away, clothes are taken out and given to them. So it's really important to allow people to do things. My mum would come down to the house, I would save the pairing of the socks for her from the washing. A lot of people with dementia like to fold things, so I'd do the ironing while she was there and I'd give her the pillowcases.
A little bit of agency out of that.
She had agency, and I would say, no free lunch here, mum, right, sort the sandwiches there. And she would have a knife and she would cut it. And the fear is, oh my God, they could damage themselves. But we all have the agency and the right to assess risk. And we now know that, you know, we used to determine capacity in terms of, a person with dementia has no capacity to make any decisions. Now we do it on a decision by decision basis because it is more accurate. So I do think that people should have the right to choose risk if it makes life more enjoyable.
So you've alluded there to some of the difficult behaviours, and these can be really distressing for people to deal with. Agitation, that can become kind of violence and disappearing, all that. You have quite practical tips on that there are usually triggers for these things, and you can identify
I think it's important to say it's distressing for the person with dementia as well as for the person without. Generally speaking, it's thought that it refers to some sort of unmet need or something that is irritating. So really it's very simple. It would be called observational diary keeping. You know, just really watch what precedes certain behaviours. And I argue you do this for what precedes really pleasant behaviours too, so that you can have more of those. So your aim is to maximise the pleasant days and encounters and to minimise the difficult and challenging ones. But you will frequently find, that it can be something, uncomfortable clothes. I mean, I often think a person with dementia is handed clothes. They wear them for the day. I sometimes change clothes during the day. Oh, the belt on this is bothering me, or I want to wear something looser, and we don't give them an option to choose. They can't voice the opinion that actually this is itchy. It may be something in the environment, a very noisy environment. It could be, and sundowning is something that's quite challenging.
Explain sundowning.
Yeah, so sundowning is a term that describes the tendency in some patients for those challenging or neuropsychiatric symptoms to get worse later in the day as the sun goes down. Now, there's a lot of theories around why that might happen. There's no definitive theory. It could be just like when you're sick, your symptoms with flu, your symptoms get worse in the evening. It could be something to do with light. But we do know that if you interact in certain ways by ensuring that the person gets outside during the day, ensuring that they have stimulating activities, boredom is a big issue. I feel there's no medical need.
You see, we don't think of that.
No, there is no medical reason for people with dementia to all be housed in the one place. In fact, it really doesn't make sense because they're not going to be able to stimulate and interact each other. So that's there for ease of running the place. Boredom is a huge issue with dementia that leads to some of these symptoms. So, and actually that's not just for people with dementia. For a lot of older people, sitting around doing nothing, it's that thing of us doing things for people. There's kind of no sort of meaning. And unfortunately...
Yeah, purpose. Like, purpose. Everybody needs a purpose
in
the
world.
We
need purpose, meaning in life. And we need to be doing things. And boredom sets the stage for dementia. And the thing... for depression. And the thing is, symptoms of depression can appear like symptoms of dementia, and I talk about that in the book. If you think your loved one, and as I said, my mum was prone to depression, some of the symptoms might actually be depression symptoms. So if you address that, you may find that the underlying dementia symptoms aren't as severe as you think they are. But yes, of course they're capable of being bored. And also, the nuance of if you're in a nursing home, often you'll find they play music, and I kind of go, did you ever ask the patients whether they like that music? Do you know, it could be like torture. And even for mum, like, music was wonderful for her. And the internet and YouTube is a fabulous resource for entertaining people. Yeah. I used to play her laughing funny baby videos and she'd laugh her head off and interact with them. Thought she was making. Yeah. I used to play music. I used to play Val Dunican because I remember that from my childhood. I remember then looking for music and I remember playing Vera Lynn for her and she said, oh, that one, turn her off. I never liked her. An assumption on my part.
Still there.
One day she
I'm getting loads of texts, Sabina.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I'm listening with tears flowing here, remembering my darling husband who danced with this disease until February 2024.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
This is from Caroline. I never saw myself as his carer, but always his wife, and I always saw him and not the disease. Thank you for talking about the ways we respect and allow the person with dementia to live and die with dignity. Nora Owen is on, who has done fantastic work in raising awareness around this. And great to hear a good, strong discussion on dementia. It helps to lessen the stigma attached. I remember going into my mom in hospital when she had advanced dementia. But, and this is the emotional memory of people, her face lit up when she saw myself or my sister. The term emotional memory makes total sense. We completely went with the moment and we had some lovely times. Someone else saying, this is all very familiar. Sabina's advice is great. I went through this with my mum for over 10 years. I learned to meet her where she was. If she was admiring clothes, we chatted about clothes. Keep your sense of humour. I cared for my godmother with Alzheimer's and see all that is there of the person. I truly believe they recognise the special connection of a loved one deep in their psyche. 10 weeks ago, our 98-year-old amazing dad was living at home alone and driving. An infection has changed his world utterly, with associated delirium so well described in your interview. Having lived through Alzheimer's 7 years ago with our beautiful mum, we're in a different world now with dad. This conversation is so necessary and so helpful. There's a lot more there. There's another one here. And again, this is about, you're very big on the carer minding themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And,
I'm an only child. I knew I could not do physical care. So for years before mum was ever sick, I always said, it will be the nursing home for you, but I'll be there every single day. And that's what I did. You need to be the carer you can be to keep your loved one safe and minded and trying to keep that connection to them since their last breath. And look, this is, I'd say some of what you're saying, Sabina, is probably going to be an eye-opener and challenge the assumptions that a lot of us who have not had this experience might have. Like, there can be this notion, say, of the long goodbye in dementia, that the person is slowly less there every day, and that the death is an expected thing, and that sometimes people, it was almost a relief when they went, can be the assumption.
Well, I think anyone who, you know, if you've seen someone suffer, and the later stages of dementia are very, very different. You know, the brain stem is affected, and so ability to swallow, etc. So sometimes there can be a release from that. However, I'm not a fan of the long goodbye. I think it fails to acknowledge the individual that lives there. It's really focusing on a disease and focusing on what it's taking away rather than on the person. I feel, I was talking to Katrina, about this, and I've never identified with it. I think it's, I don't think it's particularly helpful to consider that you're gradually saying goodbye. I think you should be, you know, connecting as partners to try and make what life... I mean, we're all dying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We are all dying.
Yeah.
So what we need
we're
to do...
We're all in the long goodbye, Sabina.
I've lived longer than I have left to live. And so what that makes me do is, I got to make the most of the rest of I have of my life. And I want to be able to be strong and fit when I'm older. And I think that should not change if I get the disease dementia. I want someone to say, right, Sabina, what can we do to help you still enjoy? They will know that I love being out in the garden. That's my go-to, you know, reset for my brain. And I hope that if that happens to me, they'll take me out and they'll garden with me.
So you'd have written down anyway and told them everything you want before that happens.
That.
Yeah, we should all probably make some kind of a living will.
Yeah, just a little notebook,
Listen, that's terrific. Thank you very much. And the book is called Still Me. And look, if this is visited on somebody suddenly, they could do better, they could do worse now than just get that, because it is kind of as close as you'll get to a roadmap of what might be ahead of you and how to
Thank
look
you
after
for saying
yourself.
That. That's
and it's Still Me, published by Green Tea. Dr. Sabina Brennan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brendan, for having me on.